This is the Empower Podcast. Released August 19th, 2019. Episode 455. Bill and Dave's Excellent Equipment.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Back with the same intro we've been doing for a decade.
Not a decade. I was actually thinking, well, I think August 10th was our anniversary. Happy 9 years. We're entering our 10th year.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Started in 2010. So.
Yep.
The 10th year of the Amp Hour commences and... We're sorry.
Yeah, that's about all we can say.
we'll try harder next decade.
Right.
Well, let's ask what's new then. What's new with you, Dave?
What's new with me?
Yeah, with you.
There's not
you.
Much new with me.
I don't know.
We can talk about my latest video, if you like.
Sure.
And the debacle
Why don't we start with that? I've got some things to talk about, but yeah, I think let's start with the debacle. So this is the multimeter.
This is the Vion multimeter. For those who aren't aware, it was a Kickstarter and Indiegogo, because you've got to have two sucks of the salve these days.
Right? Of course.
Nobody just goes on one platform anymore. It's always
dual platform,
usually at the same time. You know, Anyway. It's a thing. So they raised over $500,000 Yankee bucks, I think, for this little dinky multimeter. It looks like two probes, basically, with a curly cord between them. And it's a Bluetooth multimeter that hooks up to your phone. You know, it doesn't do much unless you hook it up to your phone. It's got some LEDs in the tip of it to light up red, green, and blue and stuff. To show your various statuses of things. But apart from that, yeah, you got to hook it up to your phone app. And they promised everything. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And the worst part is they promised like a shopping cart experience, so that if you test a light bulb or a fuse and it's blowing, it'd automatically order you a new part.
Okay.
Instantly you can kind of start seeing the problem with that.
It's a marketplace. It's a marketplace.
It's just unbelievable. For those whose brains aren't engaged at the moment because you're listening to the Amp Hour, what that means is that, well, they're probably on their exercise bike, you know, or walking the dog or whatever, you know, not just, you know, spacing out, listening to the Amp Hour.
Sure.
Who the hell wants to engage their brain? Takes energy.
Right.
Anyway, right. Let us analyze it for you. We obviously, you have to know exactly the type, rating, and all the specs of the product that you need, that you're actually testing first. So what's the point, like, having a shopping cart thing that can just... Anyway... So dumb. And they promised it was, you know, like the world's easiest multimeter, so that anyone can use it, of course. And it you know, just like nobody, people who know nothing about multimeters can use this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd never have to call a repairman again, because you'd be able to fix stuff yourself, because you'd be able to test that something's broken and then automatically order it on your shopping cart to come, and you just replace it, and you don't... Oh, God. It's... Yeah. It's that
bad.
Well,
okay, so
anyway,
that's a bad business model, but that's not a bad multimeter necessarily. So
no,
keep going.
Not okay. Yeah. Anyway, it actually took them a year, so they're more than a year and a quarter later. So, which is not a problem, right? These things happen, and they were really good in their updates. Actually, they were, you know, posting photos, and they got bad parts from AliExpress, and you know,
well, of course,
it's like shock horror, right? So they were really good at all the update and everything, and they kept having excuses. People said scam, but you know, they were posting. You know, it was obvious that they weren't scamming. They were doing, you know, real hard work to get this thing to market. So hats off to them, right? And anyway, they finally shipped. But before they shipped, they did this update that said, oh, look, Great news, we're about to ship. And sort of like in the small print at the bottom said, oh, by the way, the capacitance mode doesn't work, the inductor mode doesn't work, the voltage output mode doesn't work, we couldn't get that working, the app is buggy, it doesn't really work properly, we'll like needs another
month. It's not really a multimeter, it doesn't really do anything.
It doesn't really do anything, but we're going to ship it anyway. Yay. And everyone started shouting, refund. And they actually offered refunds. But I don't believe, I haven't heard that anyone's actually gotten a refund yet. So I'm not sure what the deal is there, but they did actually offer it. But anyway, they started shipping all these things out and somebody sent me one. So it turned up in the mailbag. So I decided to do this video on it. And as always, there's a big thread over on the EEV blog forum called the world's silliest multimeter, because the concept and the app just looks so silly. It was just all the stuff they were trying to do with it. It was just dumb. But like you said, right, it's like, yeah, they'd eventually find out that all the stuff they'll try to do is dumb, but it could have been a potentially useful USB multimeter for want of, I'm not going to write home to my mum about it, right, but it could have worked. Anyway, I got one and like...
So the idea is like that it's Bluetooth, okay, so that's not
it's,
bad.
It's
that's
Bluetooth been... only, yeah.
Yeah, so what's her name? Mushimeter did that, right? We had Eric on the show.
Yes, that was
James.
One of the first. There's the PoKit one, which was another Kickstarter successful one done by a company here in Sydney, which used to be David Tu's former employer, actually.
Oh, okay, I mean, and the concept isn't bad. I mean, like the idea of a wireless multimeter.
It's not necessarily bad. There's a niche market for it. Like it's
totally,
not going to set the world on fire, right? So.
Yeah. Mm. Right, but I like the idea of like the voltage isolation and the basically having streaming capabilities. You could be isolated. You could actually be like physically isolated from I remember they showed it like within a test chamber on the other side of like a
right. Yep. Yeah. Of course.
When they were measuring what's it called, Tesla coils, stuff like that. You're far away.
Yep. Yeah.
So
of course.
You're safe.
Yeah.
Oh, so I like that idea.
Inside. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Absolutely. But this wasn't really designed for that. No, this was designed for Joe Average to, test things. Around their home,
At the end of the day, I'm wondering, like, who's going – are people, like, browsing Kickstarter and Indiegogo still, or is it like they're getting sucked up into ad campaigns?
No, they do. People browse the tech categories. They just sit there all day browsing. There's these super backers who back hundreds and hundreds of projects. And obviously they're just, and I've talked to a few of them. I know a couple of super backers and they say, I just browse the thing and anything that sounds interesting, I just want to, sometimes they'll like just buy in for a dollar, right? I know a few people who bought into this Vion, and even though they knew like it wasn't going to do what they claimed, they bought in for a dollar just so that they could follow the saga, right?
Yeah, they're like looky-loos, but you have to pay the ticket in order to get through
you have to pay the dollar or $5 or whatever the minimum buy-in is to follow the
that's interesting.
Hilarity just in case they do the private updates and stuff like that. Anyway,
I feel like there's the potential for like a stronger community, and obviously a lot of people are great with like backing Patreon and of like different channels and stuff like that, but like it just feels like wasted energy,
I know. It's but people just love their tech gadgets and they just and granted, Kickstarter's a place to find new, I'm going to put innovative in quote marks, right? Because we don't need another 3D printer, it's like, but, or another cooler or another, the coolest cooler. And, people just love their tech stuff, so they just browse. And maybe you can get, I don't know, I've never tried. Can you get like email alerts from Kickstarter and Indiegogo about new programs? Maybe. Yeah. Anyway, that's where a ton of people come from.
Yeah, I was wondering, I had this discussion with someone recently, I forget who, but I was like, I was trying to estimate like, it was someone who actually makes dev boards. That's what it was. And I was kind of asking like, well, what percentage of the boards that are kind of like that are ordered, right? At the beginning of a project, you see a flashy video and you see like, oh, this is all the things you could do with this thing. What percentage are actually using them? Because I know I have a box. I literally have a box
yeah, I know.
Of dev boards,
same
right?
Me.
And
yep,
like, and the summer back the campaign. Some of them are just, oh, that looks interesting. And it's like the story that I told myself was like, oh, I'll definitely use this for something. But like, of course not, you know, like,
nah, that's
just
right.
From a practical perspective, like I can't use every platform. I can't, it's stupid to do that and keep trying these things. Anyways, like, so what is the percentage of like utilization of dev boards? And then I said it, you know, the extreme example would be like, I think Raspberry Pi is at like 25, 30 million boards sold at this point.
Yep.
How many are actually in like active use on a daily basis?
Oh, I would be stunned if it's 10%.
Oh,
I would
be stunned
if it's reaching
it
double digits. Really? Yeah. I wouldn't argue with that. Yeah. Yep.
Just because I think about like, okay, so like 10%. So like, let's use 10 million. That's an easy number, even though I know it's more. Right.
Yeah.
So that would then mean like, so 10% of that would be 1 million. 1% would be 100,000. Like 100,000 people using a Raspberry Pi every day? Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I guess you'd have to multiply that by four or whatever they've sold all told.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's just an interesting thing. I just feel like a lot of dev boards and projects and stuff like that are supported and like, you know, God bless them because that props up the people who are using it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right.
And
it makes these things
actually
exist for when you do need them.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine if we didn't have the ecosystem of dev boards that we have now.
Sure.
That you actually
take for
granted. Now, like if you want to get a job done, right, there's a dev board or a, you know, some sort of module out there to do it.
Yeah. Oh,
it's great.
It really.
Whereas when
as a consultant now, it definitely saved my bacon a couple times.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's obviously depending on the product. Dev boards are like that, but something like a multimeter is like, it's a tool that you can use daily.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, it's much greater usage.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Well, and I think that what that points to is that like in any of these projects where you're doing crowdfunding or anything like that, you know, it can't just be like, hey, here are the raw specs. It has to also be like, you know, here's the project you could do with it. Even, you know, if it's kind of contrived, it's like, yeah, if you have another microcontroller platform, yeah, you could do a lot of things with it, but you still need to show a couple things that you did do with it, an actual thing, actual like end products or projects rather, so that people are like, I want to do that thing, you know, like.
Exactly. Or I might need to do that thing, or I better have it in my toolkit.
Yeah, right.
Just in case, you know.
I don't know when I need to set up a 1,000 tap for a filter. You know, I might need to.
Yeah, that's like, right.
You know,
never know.
I should have that. You know, Xilinx Zinc dev board. You know, I need to pay $200 for this right now. Yeah. Oh. I may have had this conversation in my head before.
Well, you shouldn't laugh, but it is kind of funny how, you know, most of them, like only single-digit percentages end up being, you know, used for anger. Like,
yeah, I mean,
like people usually get it and then power on and have a fiddle with the app that comes out of the box. I'd say, you know, probably more than half would be doing that, right? But after that, it's like, oh, yeah, it works. Let's light up. Yep. Got my warm, fuzzy feeling knowing that I backed this project and it turned up. But in the case of the Vion, it's like this is going straight in the bin as soon as people got it. There are people who have paid for it and it's come into their country and they've got, you know, it's stuck in customs or whatever. So they've got to pay, you know, an extra $20 to get it through customs in these pain in the ass countries. Right. And all you see in the comments is, nope, I didn't even bother. I didn't even bother paying it. It's just, I'm not going to spend any more money on this. It's like, just based on their own updates of the thing, let alone when my review hits the airwaves, you know. So,
that's funny.
Anyway, there was like nothing on it that was commend, like nothing on it that was good. I think the only thing I actually commended was that it was a reasonably fast update rate. That was it. Like everything else either didn't work or was flawed or was, you know, wow.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, like the
shocking,
hardware,
huh?
It might have been useful, you know, if the app was perfect, but the app was just absolute garbage. So,
That's too bad.
Unfortunately, the app makes the product. So,
Right, yeah. right.
And anyway,
well, and that's something that could be updated, but it's not necessarily going to be.
It could be. It's not going to be. No. And unless somebody reverse engineers the whole thing and then just does their own from scratch, nobody's going to bother because the hardware's not that great anyway. And the one of the funniest things was is like it's the world's simplest multimeter, right? But the app has this sensitivity button that you can sensitivity plus minus. It doesn't explain what it does, and if you hit it, it can give you completely wrong values. I'm talking like 5 volts from a 9 volt battery or 10.5 volts from a 9 volt battery. Like, wow.
You know, it's if the precision, the digits of precision, you know, go the wrong direction there.
Yeah.
Just rounding actually, up or rounding down.
Oh, from a technical point of view, though, right, this is actually a real interesting example of where they're completely kamikaze because they didn't use a multimeter chipset in the front end, right? They've just got a microcontroller on there. It's one of those Bluetoothy, you know, ARM micro, you know, integrated things. So presumably
like an NRF chip or something.
Yep. Yes. I think it's one of those. And it's got to be built-in analog to digital converters or whatnot. And you know, so they're using all that. So they're doing all their own switching and every, you know, so there's a bunch of transistors on there that just switch in the various, you know, loads and configurations for the different functionality, right? Whether or not it's measuring resistance, it's measuring voltage, AC or DC, and so they rolled all that themselves. And I'm not sure if you've seen inside the data sheet of a multimeter chipset, but they're even like a $2 multimeter, right? They are incredibly complex. There's so much going on to make and to give a multimeter its functionality, especially its auto ranging functionality and every and all the different modes that a multimeter in quote marks can actually do. And it's but they chose, oh no, we'll just use a microcontroller with an ADC, which is okay. Fine, but you got to know what the hell you're doing, and they've completely.
So I haven't seen the chipset, but I've seen the what it takes to actually have a device do that. When I used to work at a test and measurement company, you know, like basically it was the more complicated version of what they were trying to do, and it's like no, that was like a huge software stack to get all those things doing, and then you know you have to have all the switching right, you have to have all the timing right, and the capacitance on your gate set up so that you're you know switching at the right time too. So it's pretty
it's nuts.
It's really important.
I just sent you a link to the one used inside the 121 GW multimeter.
Oh yeah, okay.
And if you scroll down to like page 21, right, you'll start seeing the function network of what's you know happening inside a like an example app.
Yeah, this is like a hard logic version of what was happening inside a
inside a Keith Lee electrometer or something. And yeah, it's like okay, yes, you can roll your own, but no. So they
but not
like,
for the low cost that you really not in a short amount of time.
No, exactly. Yeah. And no, you just it's hard enough to drive these things, right? Mm-hmm. Let alone you might use a multimeter chipset, but there's hundreds of registers in there that if you don't set them up right, you're going to completely kamikaze. But at least you can fix that in software, right? You fix that in firmware. But if you screw it up in hardware, you are gonski.
Yep.
So, yeah. Anyway, so they had to add this sensitivity. I just thought it was hilarious that they had to add this sensitivity feature. And it's like, yeah, Joe Average is going to know what sensitivity is, and they're going to think that their 9-volt battery is giving out, you know, 5 volts. Like, wow. Anyway, complete and epic fail. We were talking about your former employer, Keith Lee.
We were, and you were making fun of me.
Just before the show, I was making fun of you because you just casually dropped...
GPIB.
And I instantly like, and my mind just rattled for a second, and I kind of got like a twitch in my neck, and it's like, what? Nobody calls it GPIB.
On the other GPIB, side of the pond, they do.
If you
Dave,
don't know what, but apparently you say they do it, Keithley. That's the
the ones that I GPIB. Knew there. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, really? Yeah. I've never heard anyone call it GPIB. It's always GPIB.
I'd be okay with it going away. It is a old and tired standard, but it's out there still. And you had made a video about it. That's why I brought it up.
I did a recent video about an Ethernet interface. Yeah, which is
it's a good idea. I mean, like it really is.
yep.
to have that kind of
thing
out there.
How you can network. Like, it's not good if you just want to control one instrument. Mm-hmm. What it's good is if you want to network, like, 20 different instruments in a rack.
Right.
Like, if you don't know, GPIB is like a parallel multi-drop bus that so you stack these cables all in parallel, all these instruments, and it can have up to 30 addresses, if memory serves me correctly. Yeah, so you can have up to like 30 instruments. Mm-hmm. And
well, it's kind of like that.
I don't know.
Do you remember that? Yeah. Did you see that tweet that I forget who it was. I'm looking up on Twitter. Someone had set up like that crazy setup. Here it is. Robbie Noel on Twitter.
Oh, is that one in like there was just like 3 or 4 days
Battle
ago.
Battle Station is armed and operational.
Oh, that was great. Yeah. I retweeted. Yeah. That's just brilliant. That's like a research.
Yeah, it was
setup. It was for.
Yeah, so it was lock-in amplifiers,
was it doing?
And there's two superconducting magnets, and a bunch of measurements around it. We'll share the Twitter thread.
Beautiful. Did you see the pegboard they had with the like splitters and everything? So they had these splitters attached to these pegboards, and then the coax is running out of them. And rather than just have it like flapping around in the breeze, they actually went to the effort to stick it onto these panels. It's really great.
Yeah.
It's really great. Have you ever used one of those lock-in amplifiers?
No, like a Stanford Research Systems kind of thing?
Yeah, Stanford Research lock-in amp.
I was always doing like that's like higher frequency stuff, right?
It doesn't have to be. It can be extracting. Basically, if you don't know what a lock-in amplifier is, it gives you the ability to extract your expected signal out of the noise. Like, so if you've got, they're often used in physics experiments. I won't pretend to understand why or, how, but so if you're expecting a one megahertz carrier to be coming back from some test thing, but it's buried in like volts of noise. You're expecting a 5 microvolt signal to come back, but it's buried in volts of noise. Mm, a lock-in amplifier can extract that signal out of ridiculously high noise. It can go down to nanovolts even, right? It can extract a signal down in the nanovolt range, like crazy stuff. So apparently it's big in the physics community. So as you can see in that photo, this is
I just
not
found
visual,
what they were doing too. So further down it says they were testing 2D crystals like graphene, multiple taps bonded, sample sandwiched between two plates, inducing a variable electric field running in the 3 helium, 4 helium dilution fridge. I assume that's the isotope.
Obviously.
And then ramping up to plus minus 18 Tesla. Oh my God.
For those who don't know, a Tesla's a pretty big unit.
That's right.
a farad. A farad is a pretty big unit.
Right, right. When you get to farads, you're really chooching there. I feel like, I look at this kind of stuff too, and I'm like, man, I just don't do anything important at all.
Like
these kind of like science experiment things, like they're too, like obviously this is well funded. It's got a lot of equipment in here too. Yep. Like, but man, this like raw science stuff, holy shit.
Yep.
Like they really, well,
like
hats
I've,
off,
I've
Robbie.
Done some raw research stuff, but it's not, physics research, but I've done, research on crystals and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. Like it really feels like you're really doing, real meaningful experiments. It's like, oh, nobody's ever, I don't think anyone's ever done this before.
Yeah.
Wow, what are we going to discover? Kind of thing. Or maybe someone has, but it's in some obscure research paper that you can't find on the interwebs,
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to just run the experiments yourself and find out what happens.
Yeah.
So
I think that's the same kind of feeling like when I look at like space, like older space, not even older space stuff, like space stuff too, where like people are like doing this kind of stuff, like launching stuff into space. I'm just like, where do you even start,
Right.
And obviously there's tons of institutional knowledge. You'd never do it as a solo person.
Of course.
So you're part of a bigger team.
Even SpaceX, for example, they it's not like they just hired all these green engineers. No, they hired
NASA veterans.
Who had done self-landing rockets before, right? Because they didn't invent it. It was like, it was done in the 80s, right? So they hired a lot of these old people and they knew how to do it.
Actually, I don't think I mentioned that on here before. One of my friends from co-op, he had contacted me to be on the show at one point, so I'm not going to say his name here, but and hopefully he still will be. But like one day I found out, I was like, you know, I just kind of lost track of him. And then someone's like, hey, yeah, have you talked to him in a while? I'm like, no. He's like, yeah, did you see, let me send you a link. They sent me a link of that grasshopper video. Remember the early Tesla, like the rocket that went up? Right? And like then hovered and landed again. And he's like, they're like, yeah, he designed the control system for that. It's like, oh my God.
Sweet.
Jeez. I mean, like, yeah, people doing that kind of thing. Unsubstantiated too, but like, you know, like that's the kind of thing where it's just like, you know, that's some legit things. Whoever designed that.
What the hell were we talking about?
We were talking about research, and before that, GPIB. Oh, you just said it. GPIB, yeah.
Does anyone else call it GPIB outside of Keithley? Please let us know.
Yeah, that'd be good to know.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, the real fun thing with GPIB is when you're when you do have the stacks and stacks of machines kind of like networked together, and you start like piling up the cables. You know, and they're like, you know, because like the cable itself is probably what like. I don't know.
Oh, they're
like,
big and thick, and they're heavy, and they're
like 10 centimeters like, each one. I mean, or so.
Oh yeah,
and like,
they're beasts.
They really start to stack up, and they're heavy. Yeah, the cables themselves are super heavy, and they're like they're just industrial, old school, and they screw together because they'll fall off if you don't because they got so much weight to them. They're not fun. I'm not a big fan, but but like you said in that video too, it's a good way to get access to old. Old gear, which is really nice.
Yes.
And if you can get it on the internet, then you know you can start to do more scripting. The scripting with it with GPIB itself is pretty rough. I mean, like if you look at the language that most of them accept, it's pretty annoying. Mm. But like, you know, and then you put it into Python, you start to or something similar, you could really start to make it a little bit easier. And get some old gear off eBay too. You know, all that stuff can really start to help. So
because all that old gear, they haven't improved on the actual performance that much. Right, they've just like you know changed the UI and they've you know done a few other
niceties.
It's like you know some of them are like I've got a Keithley electrometer here, right? It's only beat by like one other, like it's like 40 years old or something. It's only beat by what like one other on the market, I think, and not by much. Mm-hmm. It's like its performance is pretty kick ass, right?
Well,
but it's
I mean, yeah, I guess the limits of, you know, component sourcing and stuff like that, if you're going to have like a really good resistor, it's always going to be really good. Well, not always, but that, you know, whatever the defining spec is.
Right.
But some of the, you know, some of the silicon in there has gotten better, I think. Depends on what you're doing.
Of course. And they've gotten smaller as well. Like
I
just did a teardown of a gorgeous old HP jitter analyzer. Did you see that video?
I did not see that one, no.
Oh, you'll have to. Oh, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Okay. It's got these, you know, it's all plug-in boards and it's huge, right? This thing today would fit on a Raspberry Pi size board, right? But it's just like you open up and the engineering that goes into that and the serviceability, it comes with a built-in service extender card in the slot. So you can actually lift the boards out, put it on the extender card so that you can work on it.
Yeah.
Like, oh.
That's nice.
Oh,
is this the one
beautiful.
Was resistor color? Someone pointed out it was resistor color coded?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
I did an update
on my second video,
Yep.
They, if you don't know, they lay like the little handles that allow you to pull up the cards. They actually color coded those. It turns out they were in the resistor color code order.
Yeah,
black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, grey, white.
That is nice.
Somebody at HP was like, yep, I'm doing these as color as the color code.
I know how to get this done. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, fantastic. And that old gear is just, it's but it's big and it's, you know, power hungry and, you know, big fans were and,
Yeah.
So, but anyway, they don't make them like that anymore. So for repairability, serviceability, things.
Yeah.
Well, they still do. In some, like, big in industrial and other markets, they do make, and military, as we'll get into, you know, make things repairable still, and they make them, you know, because, like, space really isn't, like, a real huge issue for those, you know, for things that go inside racks and, you know, stuff like that, like, size isn't really a big deal.
Right.
So you can often
Perceived sturdiness too. There is that.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, it might be able to fit inside a little Raspberry Pi size board, but you need to put in a big 19-inch rack to make it look big and grunty and
I was really surprised. I was talking to someone today about the Rigel scope that you've done a bunch of stuff on, like the upgradable one. I think the 1054, not the 1052.
The 1054Z, which is hackable.
Yep. That's $200 now. That's crazy.
Like, what? It's $200 from where?
That's what my friend said.
Really?
I don't know. But like, because there's some new version that's out there. Maybe it was like remaining stock or something.
It's got to be a remaining stock. Wow, because that's crazy. Like $400 used to be the going price. Used to be $800. Right.
When
I first got the 1052E, which was in my very first video, I actually reviewed that, my first ever video, that was $800. Then the price went to $400 a year or two later, and then it sat at $400 forever.
Yeah.
And
I kind of put that at like the lower limit of like, you know, an actual scope with a screen and probes and stuff like that. But maybe not. Yeah. Maybe it's, and that's the thing, like, you know, things keep getting cheaper, but there are some limits on, like, you know, you got enclosures, you got some decent chips in there. And I guess maybe this is kind of, if the scope started to go towards like how the multimeters were, if there was more custom silicon that could, not custom silicon, but I guess like cheaper commoditized silicon, because everything has, you know, silicon in it. the multimeter chip you brought up, like if there was that for the scope side of things, that would be interesting to keep bringing down the cost of scopes. But I'll have to double check on that.
I pulled it up here. One of the cheapest prices on sale is $349. So I don't know where $200 came from.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's like, geez, that'd be, geez, you'd just buy a spare one for that.
Right.
You know,
right.
If it was $200, like, you'd just buy a second one because then you can have an 8-channel scope.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
if you, you know, it's like, yeah, you would just, and that'd be a no brainer. Geez, you know, that's just nuts. Speaking about custom silicon and Rigel, that's interesting because you know how Rigel rolled their own. They're now one of the big players. They rolled their own ASIC. It took them years to do, right?
Oh, I thought they were still doing FPGA stuff.
No. They rolled their own ASICs. They're their new 5000, 7000 series scopes. They use their new Phoenix chipset, they call it. And and they're one of the big players because they rolled their own ASIC. But if you use any of their new scopes using this new ASIC, it lacks the high-res boxcar averaging feature, which, like, every scope on the market has. And for some reason, it's mysteriously missing in all of the new Rigel models, and they don't want to say why. I suspect, my theory is that it's not they forgot to put it in. My theory is that they put it into the chipset and it didn't work.
Yeah,
and because it was the ASIC and they don't want to spend the millions of dollars to remask that thing, they just went, well, we'll just switch it off and hope nobody notices. So if you do know the exact reason why Rigel's new, brand new scopes don't have high-res feature, then
can you explain that? Sorry,
I'm
not enough of a scope person to know what you're talking about.
Oh, right. Most scopes have an 8-bit analog-to-digital converter, right? But you can enable a high-res mode where it does a boxcar averaging. A boxcar averaging, that's just the technical name for the averaging filter used. But it basically uses a roll-in average filter after the ADC stage, like, you know, at the sampling stage before it gets processed and everything else, as so that by averaging your samples, you can get a higher effective number of bits. So you get a cleaner waveform, right? Got it. Get a higher resolution. And some scopes, you can actually, the way they do that is in the user interface, it'll go, how many bits do you want? It's like, do you want 8 bits, which is your normal mode? Do you want 9 bits, 10 bits, 11 bits, 12 bits, right? It doesn't have a 12-bit analog to digital converter in. It's only got an 8-bit one. But by doing the boxcar averaging on the fly, you can get an effective greater number of bits. And
do you lower your sample rate because, like, your effective sample rate drops then too?
You do effectively lower your, yes, you do. So, You see, yeah, but it does, like, so it's not done at the post-processing stage.
Yeah, it's not in
stage.
The GUI where you're just, like, doing an overlay.
It's not in the GUI where it's just doing, no, it's actually just at the output of the analog, it's inside the sampling chip,
sure.
Right?
The
ASIC or the FPGA. It's implementing this rolling boxcar average.
Yeah, okay.
And, yeah, and you know, and it's effective technique, and even the cheapest scopes, even the $200 scopes,
right.
have this.
It's, you get free right? cleaner quote unquote signals, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So if your waveform looks noisy, in quote marks, I've done two videos on that of why digital scopes look noisy. If you don't know, there are technical reasons behind that,
mm-hmm.
and compared to an old school analog scope, the answer is they aren't. They aren't inherently noisier. It's just
right. It's just you're
something
seeing,
else
seeing
is going
more
on.
Of it, yeah, or the sampling errors or something. Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, you have to watch my videos to understand that. And like, they have this brilliant feature in there, and it's just Rigol don't have
gone.
It. Gone. The new scopes is gone. Hmm. It's gone. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
These things happen. Oh man. Can you imagine?
Yeah. So if you know the story behind that, please
let
us
know.
Yeah,
it's like man, can you imagine like just getting that wrong? It's like, I get boards wrong sometimes, right? You get boards wrong sometimes.
Course.
There ain't no bodging a chip.
has anyone out there gotten a mask wrong? Have they goofed it?
Oh, yeah.
Jerry Ellsworth, I think. She told the story about how when she was working at that toy company, she told the story about how she wanted to skip the country because, like, she was in China or Singapore or somewhere. She was working on this toy chip, and it was, like, her first ever ASIC. Like, she had no idea what she was doing, but she thought she'd have a go anyway, right? And and the chip, she designed the ASIC for the Commodore 64, you know, the all-in-one.
Yeah.
Chip and the chip came back and it didn't work, and it was like, and she seriously thought about skipping the country. It's a hilarious story. We might have to link it in.
Yeah,
was it on the first episode?
I mean, the first one. Okay, I was wondering because we've had Jerry on like four times.
Right, yeah. And she wanted to skip the country, but then she thought, nah, look, I'll have a last crack at this, and she figured out that there was some unused pin on the chip, and she could put it into some weird ass boot mode that would overcome this problem, and she was able to hack it with just like a pin lift or something. So she lifted a pin and tied in a thing and boom, fixed it. And whoo, it's like, yeah, she figured out this way to overcome a silicon, actually goofing up the silicon.
Yep.
So, but and that was really lucky.
Yeah.
That was like, yeah. Oh boy.
Yep. Yeah.
So if anyone out there has screwed up a huge ASIC like that, let us know.
I don't know.
Because there's no way they could have forgotten. Yeah, would you admit it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway. Yep.
Speaking of episode 35.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of goofs, the US Navy goofed big time.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Chris about this before the show, and I'm surprised it got this far.
I'm not surprised you got this far.
You're not surprised? Well, I am, having worked in the Navy, having worked in the military and the Navy industry. I didn't work in the Navy, but I worked, you know, as a contractor for the Navy. And the headline is, the US Navy will replace its touchscreen controls with mechanical ones on its destroyers.
Yeah.
Oops.
UI problems.
UI problems. Apparently, there was a collision in 2017, and they've done the study, you know, to find out what the heck happened. Was it a Liberian oil tanker or something?
Mm.
The USS John McCain actually collided with a Liberian oil tanker. And they haven't read the whole thing, but it basically, it killed 10 sailors, right? This was a serious, you know.
Yeah.
Serious damn collision. So they investigated this to the hilt, and it looks like they found that the touchscreens that they were using to actually control the ship, right, actually steer the ship, they just, it somehow goofed it.
I'm going to step outside of reality for a while here, since this is, you know, this is a serious thing. And I'm going to talk about the Avengers, because on the Avengers, they also have a ship that has a bunch of touchscreens too. And then,
I've seen that, yes.
Yeah, and then everything goes dark. And I just always wonder, like, Okay, say you were going to have a your redundant power system needs are just like amplified, aren't they? Because now all of your touchscreen controllers have to be bulletproof, all of your power systems mm-hmm. have to be bulletproof, everything yep. else. And, you know, in the movie at least, they're like, oh no, the power's gone. And then they're still sitting there tapping the screen, tap, tap, tap. Oh, there's
tapping
all
this, the screen. You know, yeah, it's
like,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then, like, I don't know, blue screen of death is a thing, you know? Like,
yeah, right.
Like, what operating system are these things running? You know, like, I don't know.
I guarantee these are running a version of Windows. Guarantee
Windows
it.
CE.
I don't know about that, but they'd be yeah. running a variation of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, boy. That's just, yeah. No, it's not good. It's like it's like the planes that have fly-by-wire now instead of the cables.
Yeah.
There is a reason. There is a very good reason why Air Force One, spared no expense, is still a 747.
Mm.
Because why? Because it uses full manual cable controls. They can there can be a, you know, they can fly through some nuclear blast EMP thing or whatever, takes out every computer on that plane, every piece of electronics on that plane, they can still land that thing, right? Yeah. Because they've got the manual controls which go through cables right through to the back of the plane. They go to the ailerons, they go to the flaps, like, you know.
Yeah.
These manual controls, they can still land it.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like some of it is, you know, so we're moving obviously into an age, not moving into, we're in an age where, like, a lot of things are drive-by-wire, right? Even cars these days are, and, you know, all right. the car people are
yes.
probably screaming
yeah, the,
at their third radios
the,
right now, too.
The throttle does not, the actual throttle does not have a cable which goes to a little thing which opens
right.
the valve.
Right, exactly.
Right, it's...
Yeah.
But they still make it feel like that's the case, right? So they
sure,
actually put
sure.
these resistance, these artificial resistance things in the pedal to make it feel like the old school pedal.
Yeah. I mean, and like there are benefits pushing. To doing some of these things, right? The benefits are, you know, you can have greater control, greater monitoring of stuff like that, you know, like just having...
737 Max.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure, sure. But
right. Yep.
But I just mean that, like... So thinking about maybe not braking, but like, you know, more instrumentation around a braking type thing in a car, right? You can have ABS type stuff and
oh,
you know,
yeah,
you,
of course.
You can have
yeah,
other things
can,
in there in case, instead
yep.
of just having a pedal yep. that ties to the, you know, pneumatics that
right.
clamp down on a disc brake, whatever.
Yep.
But,
yeah, but you can
but complexity
still
in general
have that
is going
plus
up, right?
those automated yeah. ones. You can still have those. If you engineer it right, you can still have the automated ones do that, do their business with the manual cable controls.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean, yeah. We're standing way outside our usual area here, but it is interesting as more things, you know, like everything has a touch screen these days. Everything is controlled
yeah.
by wire, that kind of thing. And it's just, if there's not money to continually test reliability, and in this case, it sounds like it's more even of like a human factors UI type thing as well. If you don't have like each link just completely bulletproof, like I don't know how it works on as a system level, right? It's like you can't trust every link in the chain then, and then something's going to break.
Well, I don't know what happened with this touchscreen system, but I'm surprised that they got this through. I'm surprised somebody approved this.
Oh, yes. You mentioned this is your Navy experience.
They're really old school.
So,
this
yeah.
is my Navy experience talking. It's like, yeah, they love their manual controls. I worked, I kid you not, I worked for like a month on a switch.
Wow.
One switch. Like, I'm not kidding, right? It had to be the right feel switch, you know, sourcing this switch, actually building it into a test platform so that then it can go to a panel of people so that they can play with the switch and see that it has the right tactile feel, that the actual LED lit up bright enough in under various conditions, like the backlit thing. Was
wow.
it even LED back then? It may not have been.
No,
it's been bulb still.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, they, you know, they were very particular about, you know, the look and feel of that switch, right? And it was like, you know, it had to be the right way, that they just didn't accept it otherwise, you know. It just had to be, you know, perfect. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't have accepted some touch switch. It just, you know, it just wasn't going to happen.
Interesting.
So,
but like,
anyway,
is it
anyway,
the, I,
yeah,
I, yeah. This is at a much bigger level, though, too. So if, like, everything's changing, you know how that goes? Like, if, like, a committee of people are like, well, we're just changing this one thing. We need approval on this one thing. But if you're like, we're going to rip out the entire bridge and do it completely different, that could be very, you know, that could be more drastic changes, I think.
Hmm. Anyway, I am looking at a photo of this. Presumably, it's the console under question, and they do have manual controls below the screen. There's like these big lever things. I actually presume they're for like the throttle or something like that to, you know, change the blade speed or whatever, you know, blade angle, blade speed, and that sort of stuff. And
well, this
and
is it says it's they're... a different it's a different ship though, USS oh, Truxton. It? Yeah.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm guessing they're not going to show the bridge of the John McCain.
Of the one under question.
Yeah, that's a pretty anyway. Big, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they're changing back. They went, bugger this. Like, it's not the sole reason for the accident, yeah. but it contributed to it. They're, you know, so they're going, well, yep, let's go back.
Yeah, yep.
I don't blame them. That's just, yeah. It's just
it's tough. I mean, touch yeah, screen. Working yeah. on, like, working on the interface projects. I've got one coming up that I'm working on. It's like, it's, there's a lot of, I think it just enters another realm too, right? It's like, you know, humans react very specifically to their graphical interface. Obviously everything has an, everybody has an iPhone or a smartphone these days too. So there's there's like new conventions that people are used to. And, you know, you have to kind of play along with those human factors and make sure you're doing the right thing.
So can we go back to Rigol for a second?
Sure.
It's about user interface. Have you looked at the modern Rigols?
No, it's I haven't seen any of them.
Just call up any, just Google, you know, Rigol 5000 series, or I don't know.
Sure.
And like, just look at the front panels of these things, or what's another, is it the, no, it's not the Siglet one, but anyway, some brands just look like O1 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you just look at them, they just look so like the. I think it's the Rigol that famously had 5 different fonts on the front panel. I think we've talked about this before.
Right? No, this is like... the same friend who told me about this Rigol today. He said that he watched a video where you complained about reverse italics for 10 minutes.
Yes, right. Yeah, they had these reverse italics and the, yep. And
get out,
it's
Dave,
just a
Dave.
Dog's breakfast.
Just let it go, man. Just let it go.
No, I can't let it go because no, because we're talking about user interfaces, right? And how people expect certain things. And if you told me, explain what's wrong with the scope and why a Keysight one is just looks much better and much more professional, I'd have a hard time explaining it. It's just lots of subtle cues.
Yeah, but some of it is just your expectations.
The color, the...
It's your expectations, yeah, it's... though, too. It's what you've known.
Sure. And well, there's nothing wrong. What's wrong with expectations? They've been built up over decades and decades of, you know.
Well, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means that you're not used to it, you know.
True, but then when you go to analyze it, you go, aha, this is why my brain thinks this looks really amateurish, because it does use reverse italics and 5 different fonts and all these weird colors that don't match and all mm-hmm, these, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. like, it's just, yeah.
Dave enters the design world.
we've talked about this. John Kenny from Keysight, right? He came on. He's one of the senior designers at Keysight, and a great 5-part series for anyone who has. I think it's 5 parts on my channel.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's at least 3 parts or something. And I just sit down with him in the lab and just talk about design in Keysight products, right? Agilent back in the HP. He used to work HP back in the day. You know, he actually knew Bill and Ted, right? It's Bill and Ted.
Bill and Dave.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Oh, goodness.
Bill and
Apparently
Dave's...
they're making a new one.
Yeah,
they're
not
making a
huge
new
fan.
One. John Wick's going to be in it.
Yep. You know? Yep.
Yep. Yep. I'm excited. Anyway, and he's talking about, you know, I'm sure he talked about like user interface design and how important it is and how they have teams that, you know, select the right colors and the right styling and everything else. And you can tell like companies that like Rigol, they just give it to whoever and it like, and they just don't care. And it shows. right? It really does show. You put them side by side and you end up with the reverse italics and the five different fonts and all the colors and weird grouping and convoluted
layout.
Okay, we got to get onto something else here.
We got to get...
No, why?
If I hear you talk about reverse italic for 10 minutes, I don't know, man.
You're the one who brought it up. You know, user interface.
Yeah, come on.
It's important.
Reverse
why?
Italics.
Why is it not important?
I draw the line at reverse italics, Dave.
Why?
I don't care about the look and feel really. I mean, like, I don't look at test equipment.
Well,
like
there's
you
a
do,
lot of people who do.
Yeah,
there's a lot of
right,
people
right,
who
right.
do, right?
Right?
And it can matter if you're designing a product, seriously. If you're designing a product and it doesn't look professional, people won't treat it as a professional product. And that reason might be because you got some dummy like me to do the user interface, right? It's like,
yeah.
It's going to look amateur.
Sure.
So, yeah. Anyway, I know you don't care about the small details like this, but they're important. That's why I like discussing them. It matters.
Yeah.
All right, go on to your next topic. Fine. Fine. Go ahead. Come on. Make it good. Better be good and interesting.
I know, reverse italics. Let's see. How can I segue this? You should send the scope back if you don't like it.
Well, you shouldn't buy it in the first place. You can obviously
see
from the screenshot.
Right. You should send it back if you don't like it, unless you can't, because it's non-returnable. That was my segue.
Well done. Yes.
The parts that I've talked about two weeks ago, I was like, you know, I think I'm actually going to use different parts. And I went to go return them. And Dave and I were talking about before the show, too. It's like, yes, parts
are
actually...
cheapest ones you bought because they were like rock bottom price. You want to return them.
Right. Because I figured out another solution, right? And I could talk about that later,
right.
too. But like, and then I like went to go hit the return button. And yes, there is a return button on like a DigiKey, right? And then it's like, no. Those are NCNR. It's like, oh.
What's NCNR?
Non-cancelable, non-returnable. As soon as I hit the buy button, oh, those were coming to me no matter what. So.
Isn't that default if you get them on tape?
No.
If you get them on cut tape,
will they accept
cut tape as a return?
Really?
I thought you could only return like full reels and stuff or
you know
full
what?
Tubes.
I can check this real time actually because I have a DigiKey order out right now. But I think you can return tape. Maybe not. Maybe that's not right. But definitely reels you can. And
yeah, right.
Yeah. So like you think about if you're a CM and you like overorder the number of parts, I think there's probably a restocking fee. But
you
got to pay like handling and stuff like that. But you can't like, you know, if you buy like, you know, like a reel of components very easily can hit in the thousands of dollars. And then you're sitting in the stock.
Tens of thousands even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't want to sell it on the gray market. So, it's you can basically just return it. And that's kind of nice. Not everywhere. And obviously, if it's marked NCNR, you cannot. But that's nice for some things. So.
Yep. It's just never occurred to me to actually return anything.
Right. Well, you and I aren't ordering a lot of things that are like that. So. Okay, so
sometimes I do pay thousands of dollars for one reel of components.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And it's like, but I've actually used them. Like, if I did pay thousands of dollars, yes, I would be looking to get my money back.
Right.
Either sell them on the gray market, as you said, or actually return them. So.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
So I'm on the site right now, and I can return. Let's see the 10. 1.8 picofarad capacitors that I bought on my last order.
What?
I can return those for a credit of
$0.30.
No, I will not do it because it's a $7.50 return shipping. So I will not be doing that. But I could.
So it costs more to ship them back than
it would to keep
them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And I think that's logistically that makes a lot
of
sense. But
yeah, it does.
Yeah. So it turns out you can.
That's great.
Right. Didn't know that. But we were also talking about because. I've got a bigger build coming up at as soon as I get the parts. But we were talking about like, you know, when you put in orders at lead time and, you know, if I got a 16-week lead time on something, I need to get in line for those parts. And I'm not 100% on this, but I think you don't necessarily have to take delivery on all those parts. You at least need to get in line, right? So if I want parts,
right,
I need a forecast for 16 weeks from now that, like, I'm going to be doing a build. But in the event I don't do the build, it's possible I can just
cancel.
You're
not forced to pay.
Yeah, right. And so I don't think that, you know, it would be a smart idea to, like, go and order all the parts, because at some point they're going to be like, okay, well, give us some money before we're going to, you know, put you in line. But like, from a risk mitigation kind of standpoint, like, getting an order in, you know, I've pushed for that before where it's like, no, well, you know, especially if there's something that's super long lead time, it's like, I'm definitely going to need that. I'll at least put an order in and then see what happens. It's always worked out that I've used the parts, but I think you don't have to take delivery for all of them. So TBD on that one. So,
okay. I don't think I've ever done that. Maybe maybe the company purchasing people have or something like that, but I don't recall ever having personally done that.
Yeah.
I think I paid up front. You know, like, I've ordered stuff that's like 30 weeks lead time.
Yeah, right.
You know,
it hurts.
Back in the day,
it still happens. It still happens. It's tough.
But we're so used to multiple source parts these days. It's like we're really spoiled for choice.
Like,
it's nuts.
What do you mean?
I mean, when you actually design something, there's usually some sort of alternative. You know, if you're smart, you'll try and design your product around something that has multiple sources. Or if you can't, at least you know it's in stock from multiple suppliers. So unless, you know, Murphy steps in and all of a sudden when you go to buy it, oops, all the stock in, you know, five different locations is all sucked up at once.
Right.
Then generally you're able to get it. You know, there's not too many people these days that are designing a product and then waiting, you know, 20 weeks for the parts. Like, not in the small side of things. In the larger end of
I guess that's right. Yeah. Usually people aren't waiting 30 weeks for a sample or five.
No, that's right.
Five offcut from the reel. Yeah, I think you're right about that. But from then a reel
with the lean manufacturing, these, you know, everyone's used to getting something now. They get their boards turned in less than a week. They get, you know, everything. They order their parts from DigiKey and Mouser, and they do it. You know, you can design and build something in a week.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Like, waiting, you know, 20, 30 weeks is just, you know, nobody does that these days.
Right. Yeah, so, well, the thing that I always wonder about is people that, like, you know, there's, like, some really funky variants of, like, certain MCUs where it's like, we want, you know, we have to have the floating point unit, but we need the 64, you know.
Yeah, and that's not in stock anywhere. It's like,
right.
But
well,
I need,
even do
I
it
know
unless
I need
it's bespoke,
that
you know, like, it's just like they have to do a fab spin for they have to do a wafer start for it. It's like, those are the ones where, you know, like, people then are, you know, you add an external memory on a dev board or whatever it is, but that's disruptive to a development
process. As I said, that's only going to be in the reasonably big end of town.
Yeah, I think
you're
right.
You know, your average midnight engineer or small company is just not going to do that. Right. They're going to find a different way to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know? If you're digging into the spec sheet or the, you know, the ordering spec part of the data sheet, and you're like, no, I have to have this part. It's like, yeah, you're gonna hurt for that one if it's not actually a stock component.
Yeah, no,
anyway.
There's almost always alternatives to this. Yeah, if I was going for a micro and they do make this part, but nobody in the world has stock, and it's like, yeah, they're gonna have to do a fab run for it. There's no way I'm gonna design that into my product.
Right,
it's like,
right.
I would rather take the pain of switching to a different brand micro than actually waiting for that part.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So, yeah.
Speaking of micros, there was a article about the it was inspired by your video on the 3-cent microcontroller.
Yes,
but
it was.
Then it was...
It's actually Tim who's on the forum.
Oh, great. Okay. And so this was talking about other low-cost micros and stuff like that.
Basically did a shootout of sub 10-cent micros and came up with this nice little chart. I hadn't heard of most of these manufacturers.
Yeah.
Right? It's a really great article, and there's a PDF version. Let me download it. The terrible 3-cent microcontroller comparison chart. Let's have a look at some of the company names. See if you recognize them. Hands up. Let's play bingo. Pull up.
Pull up. It's like pull up.
Duke. We've heard of Padauk because it's a three-set micro I've done a video on. Bojangjing in industrial.
Right? This is going to be a terrible mangling from Dave. Yeah,
it's and a me terrible too, to be honest. Mangling.
Like, yeah.
Oh, they've got the Y-Spring Tech.
Uh-huh.
Okay. E-Spring. East Soft Micro. These are all China or Taiwan, by the way. And Holtec. You might have heard of Holtec. So.
Yeah.
Holtec's very common in. They make chipsets for multimeters, and they make microcontrollers. We're using a Holtec part in the micro supply, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Not a micro, but they make an LCD controller.
Oh, okay.
So we're actually using that. It was one of the few LCD controllers. That's one of the things where, like, we, you know, finding an alternative would have been hard. This Holtec one actually did the business and did it for a decent price. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing else.
Yeah, right.
There was nothing else out there that could match it for the price, not even close, I think. And it was like, yeah, we had to use that Holtec part.
Yep.
And anyway, yeah, there's all these different manufacturers. Great table. And but the Padauk one, they've now reverse engineered. Yeah, we mentioned this the other week. They've reverse engineered it. They've got an open source compiler for it. There's an open source programmer.
Yep, it was the SDCC was the compiler, yeah.
From SDCC.
For those of you playing at home.
Which now supports, yep. And, yeah, anyway, it's a great article comparing these and all the different pros and cons of them.
Telling me about the company that makes STMicro compatible parts? Was that you or someone else?
Don't think that was me.
I think that is... No, which one is it?
They make ST compatible.
It's like it's yeah, what, register yeah, but compatible. ST,
it's registered like as in an ST ARM. Are we talking about like an ST32 or something?
Yeah.
Really, they make a full register compatible version.
Yep. I think
because if people don't know, right, you can't just buy an ARM chip from one manufacturer and then move to the ARM chip of, like, you can't just buy an ST ARM micro and then move to an Atmel ARM micro.
Right.
You just can't do
it. You got to remap all the peripherals.
They're physically different implements.
Yeah.
All the peripherals, all the registers, they're all different. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. Yes, your base code will still work, right? You can just import that, but all your register settings and all your peripheral setups, your clocks, your timers, your UARTs, your ADCs, and all that, you know, all these external peripherals, they're all custom for each individual manufacturer, which is a shame, but that's the way it is. So you're saying there's someone fully compatible?
I was in the wrong. Let me see if I can find. I was in the supervisors thing.
Deepest, darkest alley of Shenzhen, were you? Came out and go, psst, buddy.
LCSC,
hey,
I think the reason this came up is, so after looking at the parts that I end up buying and not buying, well, not wanting them and then realizing I'm keeping them, I ended up going on, I was on LCSC and I was just looking at parts there, and there was a 35-cent STM32F030 part on there. And then like 15 cents for like a 433 megahertz receiver and a 15 cents for a transmitter. And so it's like,
wow.
Yeah, that's real cheap.
Wow.
So that's my current playing.
Right.
And we don't.
And it's a compatible part. It's not a genuine.
These are.
Because they sell genuine ones as well.
That's right. No, this is genuine. This is a genuine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And this is coming from a catalog supplier. Because they are essentially a catalog supplier, right?
Yes.
Which is generally not the cheapest way to get a part. Yet they're still so dirt cheap.
Yeah,
wow.
So it's one-fifth the price of the equivalent part at DigiKey is $1.50 for the same quantity. Yep. So like,
you did hear about LCSC, didn't you? I don't know if we mentioned it on the show.
I don't know.
Somebody busted them. They did a video tour of, or a photo tour of their production facility.
Oh, okay.
As in their pick and place, you know, where they pick and place, as in they're picking, you know, the stuff from the shelves and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And they were using one of those wireless anti-static wrist straps.
Yeah.
So I actually contacted them and said, hey, you might want to watch my video about that. And they came back and said, oh. Yeah, oops, sorry, right. We'll fix that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, ESD was precautions and LCSC were kind of out the window. So, yeah. But they've fixed that now, I think.
That's good.
Yeah. They said they would. Yeah. So.
So I figured out
anyway,
the name of the, it's Giga Device. That's who does the that's the
Giga Device.
Yeah. So if you look at the part numbers, that's where it really becomes obvious, right? So if you look at STM32
right.
normally would be, so here's an example part. STM32 F103C8T6, right? So that's the C8 package.
That's the name of the
T6.
Company.
No, that's the manufacturer part number. GD or that's
yeah, but no, sorry.
Yeah. What? Our wires are
Giga
crossed.
Giga Device Semicon is the name of the company in Beijing.
That's right, yeah.
Giga Device, wow. And
okay,
they
so STM32F0, F103CA26. The Giga Device part is GD32F103.
GD in front, instead
yeah, exactly.
of STM. Yeah.
And so like they're after STM, they basically completely replicated it. I don't understand... In the
wow.
modern world, like obviously this happens with 74 series parts, right? It's just like that's
yeah,
all out
yeah,
there.
Of course. Yeah.
But this is
yeah.
something different, and these are dirt
and,
cheap.
And there's a lot of effort that goes into that too.
Yeah,
like to actually copy a chip at the register level. That yeah. you know.
Yeah. So
wow.
Interesting. I don't know, like the cost, like the STM32 parts are pretty cheap
are
on
they,
there too. So
are companies like this actually paying the fee?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or are they just stealing that as well?
Yeah.
Like, are they just like...
Here's the real question.
Wow.
Would you put this in a product? Because I don't think I would. I'd rather just pay right now.
I wouldn't. I would definitely pay the genuine.
Yeah.
Yep. If I was making a million greeting cards or something and it didn't matter, of course.
And you're using a STM32
right?
for that, of course, because why wouldn't you?
Right. Yeah, right. I should be using the 3-cent micro, but right. you know. Yeah, no, I wouldn't put it into any serious product. If it was non-serious and I just needed, you know, if I was just doing something for, you know, something for fun, like I was designing the world's largest lead array or something like that, and I just needed, you know, 1,000 chips to actually
yeah.
do this, then yeah, I would, you know, and I had to do something simple and easy, yeah, I would use something like this. But otherwise, no.
Right. So this is actually not new, apparently. So I just found an article from Dangerous Prototypes from back in January 2018. So this is obviously not new. And then it's linked over to a comparison. So we'll have that link in our show notes, too, just for the...
Yeah. Okay, so they've got a... How deep do they go into the comparison?
Solderability, Blinken LED, UART, and Spymaster. So comparing all
oh,
that
okay.
stuff.
Oh, okay, right. So they're just some basic...
I mean, it's still
yeah,
something, though, like actually putting it on a board
oh, yeah, no,
and doing
of course.
It. So.
Yeah. No, you've got to get the oscillator configurations working. You've got to get the I.O. configurations working. You've got to
you
get
know,
the,
we may have even brought this up know. Before, too. Who God knows.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Well, because ZeptoBars right. did a shoot of it, too. So.
Right. They actually.
And
yeah.
usually when ZeptoBars does something, we mention it. So.
And is it a physical copy or is it just a register? Actual reverse engineering copies. Because
you know,
surely
tell.
They don't get access to the masks
yeah,
to
yeah.
actually copy the masks,
yeah.
right? So I'm sure they're different.
Yeah, well.
Which is, it's just remarkable. But the Chinese market is so big.
Right, especially
that it
and,
pays
like,
these
and the STM32 is like in everything. You know, like they really.
It's in
have
everything.
Huge
it's inter- the de facto standard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of yeah, it's like the ARM market like five years ago,
mm-hmm.
like 7 years, like the ARM market was so flooded. It was like like you didn't know who to choose. These days it's like you're probably going to use the STM32. Right? You know, that's kind of like if you're coming in and going I need to use an ARM chip, that's probably the one you're going to choose just because of like everyone else is using it kind of thing. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there. Supply is obviously pretty high, so that helps. Obviously, you have two vendors
yeah.
now. So, yeah. It's,
wow. Well, that could work at a pinch, right? If you couldn't get the part, somebody came along and bought up all the STM32s and you were going, shit, I need to ship my Kickstarter.
Yep.
It's
yeah.
like, well, you would have a go. Because the problem with this is that you can test it. Right, we've talked about this on the Amp Hour before. You can thoroughly test something. Like, it is not a risk to use this unless, Well, no, even then, no. There is almost, there's practically zero risk in doing this. Yeah, Dave versus spy. If you thoroughly test this, like you get this sucker in the thermal chamber, you test it over its thermal performance limits and voltage rail performance limits and clock oscillator limits and every other, you know, variation limit you can think of, you can be 100% sure that this chip's going to perform in your product.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no problem there. So I wouldn't necessarily be against using this in my product, but I wouldn't design it in from the start, right? I'd be designing in the ST one.
Yeah.
And then only in a pinch would I think about using this one. But you certainly can.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of testing, says the guy who comes from the test engineering background, right? It's like, yeah. You know, this was my, you know, this is what I did every day, right? It's just, you know, test stuff over thermal and other limits, even vibration and shock and all sorts of stuff, right? To make sure it all worked.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if I would design something like this into my circuit, you know? And by that, I mean, I don't
like
know if
I
would.
I wouldn't design it.
I don't know if I'd put a microcontroller in my circuit, Dave. That's what I was really saying. You just really
you
can't
put
trust
a micro in at all.
You can't control. You can't trust microcontrollers these days.
Dodgy as.
We should use that as our excuse to leave.
Oh, wait,
10
minutes
silliness.
Past.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I will be recording from the road next week with the Mighty Ohm and maybe Alvaro and a bunch of weirdos from Chaos Camp. So, looking forward to that.
You'll be in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're going to Iceland or something as well, are you, or somewhere?
Yep. Stopping over there too. So. That's
why,
just because
why are you going to Iceland?
Because the cheap airlines fly through there. So.
Oh right. Yeah. Okay. Are you actually going to see some sights there?
Yeah. So I'm. This is like a 24-hour layover.
Right. Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Geez, you can't see much in 24 hours, dude. Come on, it's Iceland.
Not a big country, Dave.
Yeah, but come on.
If there's any Iceland
listeners,
I've always
wanted to go there.
Jeff and I will be there. Let us know.
All right.
Catch you next time.
Catch you next time.
No, catch you next time. See ya. Why do you always get to see Catch You Next Time?